This episode is brought to you by Fuli Gemstones.
She's covered with diamonds, and her diamonds are gifts from men, so they represent male interests, so they up her stock. The more diamonds she wears, the more evidence of her sexual appeal. And the sense that men in that film are, they're kind of dopey and unreliable. But the diamonds are not unreliable. The diamonds will be there when the men are gone.
I'm Carol Halton, the voice of jewelry. Welcome to If Jewels Could Talk. I'm an author and broadcaster, and the woman who initiated the role of jewelry editor at magazines like Tatler and Vogue. This is a podcast for everyone, for people who do like jewelry, for people who don't realize they like jewelry, and anyone intrigued by fascinating facts, new ideas, and forgotten histories. So join me as I tell sparkly tales and meet all sorts of people, delving into four centuries of jewelry culture, and investigate what's happening now. This week, the Guardian newspaper ran a double-page spread on how the red carpet was ruined and lost its mystique. They said that the red carpet and everyone on it is but a bauble on the tree of self-congratulation. Well, we're interested in the actual baubles. And this week, we want to go back and look at how it all started, how the red carpet is there and how we can admire it and how the Oscars began in 1929. But of course, it didn't become a public event until the 1940s. Now, there was a golden age, and Hollywood, let's face it, has always loved diamonds. So we're going to look at that today. And I'm really delighted to welcome Maura Spiegel, who is a professor at Columbia University, who lectures in literature and film. So Maura, thank you very much for joining us from New York.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I was really interested in what Maura has written, an essay that I read of her some time ago in a book about diamonds. And in it, Maura, you really emphasized how impactful Hollywood has been for diamond jewelry and vice versa.
Yes, I trace it back to the golden age of Hollywood, the 30s and the 40s, although diamonds were appearing a little bit earlier in the 20s, you know, it was already happening. But the cinematic techniques that really develop in the 30s, the use of gauze and low-resolution lighting, they learn to accentuate the beauty of the glitter in diamonds and to really build them into stories in a more emphatic fashion.
Do you think they were really important for that sort of black and white era to add to that lovely sort of ethereal look at the time?
Yeah, I think so. And I found this beautiful little line from Joseph von Sternberg, who I think of as one of the great directors, treated Marlene Dietrich with such remarkable finesse and so forth. He says, "Glamour is the result of chiaroscuro, the play of light on the landscape of the face, the use of the surroundings through the composition, through the shaft of the hair, and creating mysterious shadows in the eyes." And I think this element of glamour, we can't really talk about Hollywood without talking about glamour in this period. There's a lot written about the idea of glamour, and it's a word that really doesn't come into currency until the late 19th, early 20th century. With the rise of movies, it really takes on a very particular meaning. Its old meaning of sort of a magic spell, an illusion, is really what movies are. So the idea of building glamour into this world of illusion and magic, it makes such a beautiful melding, and diamonds had a real place in that.
That's so interesting, because it's sort of not how we use the word glamour now, is it really? We sort of tend to skewed off into looking rich,
right?
Hasn't it? As opposed to, as you say, that's like magic. And diamonds, however normalized they are now, however that every second person on the street wears a diamond, probably in some form, whether they're lab-grown or man-made, the essence of the diamond is a sort of form of magic, isn't it, really?
Yeah, well, it's also from being associated in the 19th century novel with curses and colonized worlds, the exotic, to really a more commercialized version that we get by the time we get to Hollywood, but there's still really storied. Mm-hmm. You know, diamonds are, they have story behind them. Sometimes the story is deliberately obscured, as we see when we get to the phase where people are becoming aware of blood diamonds, right? Mm. People don't want to know where they come from.
Yes. It's sort of the best and the worst in human nature, all embodied in one thing that slightly fascinates us.
Yeah, I think that's true. And we see that in films later on, you know, when they start moving away from diamonds as being ornaments for women to being sort of this portable property that is so powerful and also can be used. I was thinking about Diamonds Are Forever, the James Bond movie. The diamonds need to be retrieved because they're building, you know, a space laser, familiar word these days. And James Bond has to fetch them before the sort of nuclear diamonds will have the potential for such destruction.
So do you think it was by the 30s that this kind of almost transaction began to be apparent between how good diamonds were for Hollywood and vice versa?
Yeah, the screen became a real showroom, a kind of a shop window for Americans. And it wasn't that long before Hollywood realized, you know, this potential for commercializing itself beyond the movies themselves. And, you know, stores like Macy's had sections where you could buy clothes that appeared in movies. And for diamonds, you know, the I think this is really the beginning of a move from diamonds as being something that just the ultra, ultra rich could wear to more, you know, the more possibilities. But I think the decision by diamond dealers, of, you know, very famous dealers, to loan their diamonds to movie stars, not just for their performances in films, but to wear around town, was a way of self-promoting. In the films, they would have their names credited at the end of the film, along with the fashion designers and so forth. And so Americans came to know all of these names as if they were household names, you know, Cartier, Tiffany's, Van Cleef & Arpels.
Harry Winston.
Yeah.
So before the stores began loaning to stars, stores were loaning to movie sets and studios.
Yeah, and it is, you know, it's also, it seems worth mentioning that this is the era of the invention of the star system, the invention of movie stars. You know, in early films, in silent films, they didn't even put the names of the star, of the actors onto the film. And fans would write in and say, we want to see more of that actor with the curly blonde hair, you know. And so they figured out, wait, we've got this thing. We've got this thing called movie star, you know, we've got this thing we can turn into something. And they started really branding these stars, these people. And then you get, again, the invention of glamour with things like Pickfair, you know, Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks Jr.'s famous mansion, the first home-owned swimming pool, and their home as this kind of elegant funfair that was really a place where people, you know, gathered and enjoyed their glamour together. But it was really creating a new notion of what, you know, American wealth could mean. And it came with fame and with all of that, the magic that was associated with the movies.
That's amazing. So they had the first home-owned swimming pool.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
And their house was full of make-believe, like a movie set. They had a saloon, like an old-fashioned, they built a saloon into the house. I mean, you know, they just, it was full of fantasy. And
fantasy
this,
and mimicking the movies at yeah, home, taking yeah. the job home with them at night. Who do you think benefited more from this synergy? Do you think it was the diamond industry? Because, you know, I was looking today ahead of our talk, and in the US, the diamond industry is worth like $96 billion.
Yeah, yeah.
And do you think that was set at that time, really? It sort of set it in motion?
I'm not 100% sure I can say who benefited most, mm-hmm. but I know that the diamonds, the fact that the diamonds were real diamonds and everybody knew they were real diamonds they were looking at in the films, added a kind of prestige, you know, because diamonds were, I think people thought in those times that diamonds came from France, you know, they seemed associated with European royalty, you know, again, not with, you know, sort of colonial endeavors or South African diamond mines. This sense of the prestige of diamonds, their, you know, connection to New York, as distinct from California, So the prestige of the diamonds certainly had an enormous effect, as well as just the beauty of and the pleasure of them. But I think, you know, the idea that women, who became quickly sort of the primary target for movies by Hollywood, they knew they had, you know, women. Certainly it was a huge boon for the business end of things. It was already conventional to have, you know, a diamond in your engagement ring. That had already become conventional by the early 20th century. But why it becomes explosive to the point where every woman gets one, you know, that idea. Democratizing the whole thing.
Yeah, well, I guess it's like the eyes of the world were then focused on that part of America, weren't they? Fashions came from Hollywood. You know, the silver screen stars were the sort of royalty that were almost touchable. You couldn't copy the Queen of England, but you could copy one of the movie stars, couldn't you?
Yes, and movie stars themselves became involved with, you know, advising women on how, you know, on makeup and hair, and, you know, they would give tips. You know, there was one tip that intrigued me, which was to put Vaseline around your eyes to make them shimmer. I think that idea of trying to, again, get to that gossamer feeling of the black and white film, even in real life, is sort of suggested by that. So there was this notion of stars being inaccessible, but somehow you could mimic them, especially, I think, for immigrant women who are becoming American. Mm-hmm. It was a way to style yourself and understand your American femininity.
That tip about Vaseline sounds like someone getting ready for their close-up. It doesn't sound like real life. You'd just go out looking greasy, wouldn't you? But unless the camera was in a particular way to capture you. Do you think that the fact that they were genuine diamonds, as you've mentioned, is very important? Because I was quite interested that recently, on both sides of the Atlantic, everyone's gone crazy on Bridgerton, the historical dramas, and in it they've replicated this sort of idea of excess of jewellery. And of course, none of it's real. It's all fake. Did it really matter then? And do you think things would look better now if they used genuine stones?
I think they can do amazing things with lighting, and I don't know that it matters. I do think that... I imagine that the insurance costs of using real jewels would be prohibitive. I'm not sure, but
yes, on location somewhere in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. I also think that there is more consciousness of, in a way, Bridgerton is so much of a fantasy. I mean, it's so filled with, you know, reimagined history and all kinds of things that the reality, I mean, I was thinking about, to make a little bit of a leap, you know, about Oscars these days and the amazing diamonds that women and men are wearing to the Oscars, but they're not wearing new diamonds. They're wearing old diamonds. They're wearing sometimes even antique diamonds. They're wearing estate diamonds, pieces that have, again, stories. But they're the feeling that there's something maybe a little bit troubling about diamonds, real diamonds these days, and that there's a greater awareness of that in the public imagination, a little bit more, at least in the world of movie making.
Mm-hmm. And you wrote that you thought that the fact that they were genuine diamonds in the golden age of Hollywood was really important to break through to a sort of a second illusion that was the viewer's fantasy.
Yeah, I think the ways in which, I mean, just to an anecdote, you know, I remember reading that when Grapes of Wrath came out, we're talking about 1940, mm-hmm. The movie was banned in the Soviet Union. The reason given was by historians was that people seeing that kind of poverty in America would be troubling, not because of the fact of the poverty, but because of the fact that people that poor could have a truck, that they could own a truck. And that when often when people in the Soviet Union watched American movies, they'd come away saying, "Oh my God, that teenager has a phone in her bedroom." You know, again, so this sense of what the secondary messages are of movies, you know, the sense of both literal value of, you know, the literal value of things versus sort of symbolic and ritual value that Hollywood stories portray. There is this sense of there's so much money there, you know, and the desire to just to have the real thing.
So do you think then that filmmaking keeps pace with our real desires and how we're living as well as our desires?
Call it the desire machine, you know. Movies are desire machine, yeah. And I think that's true. Yeah, I do think that we see these evolutions, certainly. It's interesting, the Bridgerton phenomenon, you know, again, a kind of let's revise history to include everybody. It's very beautiful in a way, but it's also a fairy tale.
Yes, at least you're right. It's a sort of fairy tale of the past. It had such an impact over here, I can't tell you. And the crown, I suppose, as well, the jewellery and the crown and the how they sort of reimagined it without using real jewellery was quite clever. I think the costume designers, we had Ellen Morozhnik on, I think our very first series, and this is now our sixth or seventh. I think the work that those costume designers do is really quite brilliant.
It is, and the reconstructions, and I was seeing how a lot of the jewels in the show are now being remade and sold,
yes,
you know, commercially. Reproductions of the reproductions.
And actually Bonhams here, the auction house, just had a big sale of a lot of the artifacts from the crown, and in that was all sorts of jewelry, paste imitations of things they had worn, some of the royal family had worn, as well as what they might have worn. But you said that stones didn't automatically confer glamour. It depended on the actress who was wearing it.
Yeah, well, I think the great movie stars had a way of expressing themselves and expressing their sort of character, their personality, so beautifully through their relationship to their diamonds. You can see it. It's wonderful. And, you know, I think of Marilyn Monroe, who feels the way they film her as well, but it's sort of like she's being warmed by the diamonds, you know, in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. They're like just, they're not cold. They're totally warm. The way that she is, they really speak to her whole expression of her embodiment and the way in which she lives in her body. You know, I love the way Greta Garbo sort of seems to feel kind of slightly, I don't know, they're almost like chains on her, you know, she transcends time. And you see again and again the Katharine Hepburn sort of doesn't care about them, you know, there's a whole sort of personality in the way that they wear them. And I think that is part of the skill of being a great actress, great actor.
Do you think that's partly because moviegoers got to know their characters? You know, Katharine Hepburn being a tomboy, so she would look like she'd dressed up deliberately to wear the diamonds, that people felt they knew them, whichever character they were playing.
Yes, and they really did, you know, build their characters through repeated, you know, stories that kept emphasizing those character traits again and again. It was a big step when an actor, actress would deviate from their traditional role. So absolutely, people did feel they knew them. I think that was part of the intimacy and the connection.
And they invited them into their lovely homes to look at their jewellery collections in a way we could not imagine now, could we?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I was in Palm Beach last week, and there was, I won't say who it was, but a major Academy Award winning actor who happens to love jewelry and watches. And so I asked if he would just come and have a general chat on the podcast about what he liked about jewelry and watches. And he just said, I just can't. You know, the risks are too great.
How interesting. It is striking to me that men have begun wearing not just fancy watches, but really pendants and wearing diamonds also to the Oscars, and the Oscars being sort of the last, you know, along with several other award shows that have now become, you know, bigger and bigger, you know, sort of the last vestiges of Hollywood glamour, right?
But you can't imagine now talking about actresses expressing themselves through their jewelry.
Well, maybe a little bit at the Oscars you could. I mean, they're so deliberate in the choices they make.
They're paid to wear those.
That's true.
That's
they are.
It's kind of, you know, I think the last ones were Elizabeth Taylor. Oprah Winfrey wears her own. But I think you could tell about women through their choices then. But now it's, you know, are they signed up to Louis Vuitton, Dior, Chanel? Who are they signed to?
Gotcha.
For that season?
I stand corrected.
Disappointingly, because And I want to talk about that, you know, Marilyn Monroe in particular, you know, the idea of, you know, maybe that sort of transactional idea between love and diamonds and how that was portrayed at the time.
To me, the great originator of this idea of sort of diamonds as being a kind of a sort of insurance policy for women. Mm. And, you know, jewelry was one of the few things that women could inherit, you know, that was a personal possession that didn't belong to the husband. You know, going back into 19th century, jewels were a woman's possession. But that idea of Ismay West, you know, who in fact, in real life, loved diamonds and collected them. And, mm-hmm. and she wrote and produced her own plays and films, and she just take things off her arm to make a play. You know, she just remove a few bracelets.
What, to finance them?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
But she really, in She Done Him Wrong, she plays it up so beautifully. You know, she owns a saloon. You know, she's set sort of in that early 20th century world. She's a saloon lady, but she's covered with diamonds, and her diamonds are gifts from men. So they represent male interests. So they up her stock. The more diamonds she wears, the more evidence of her sexual appeal, and it's quite wonderful. And the sense that men in that film are, they're kind of dopey and unreliable, but the diamonds are not unreliable. The diamonds will be there when the men are gone, and they're the things that ensure a woman's security. At the end, she's betrothed to a very young and not yet formed Cary Grant, who plays this very stiff kind of policeman who is redeeming her at the end, and he proposes marriage to her, and she's got all these diamonds on, and he's going to have to take away those diamonds because of legal matters. And so he gives her this little tiny, tiny diamond to put on her finger. You know, it's like, it's very comical because it's like she's trading in her freedom in a way, that her affluence for marriage, which is just very unusual, because most of the time that rock that you get when the man offers you that ring is security in movies, suggesting that marriage is the real thing. The diamond is just a symbol of the potential for security.
Of the goal,
yeah.
Yes. And usually indicated the end of the film, because a lot of these, they were sort of like comedies, weren't they? Or it was all leading up to the boy gets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl. And the end was the culmination of the diamond ring.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the way that we never got tired, we're still not tired of watching the making of couples, you know, it's just like how much time we sit and watch that story, you know, in our lives is really remarkable. But yes, that culminating moment.
A good rom-com can't be beaten. I always think of that moment in Sleepless in Seattle, when Meg Ryan is with the fiancé that obviously she has to ditch to get Tom Hanks, poor sleepless Tom Hanks. And there's a big moment in Tiffany with the diamond, and he's had it resized from his grandmother's ring, and in the middle of Tiffany. And I suppose that's the defining proposal moment.
That's great. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there's also a kind of tradition of disowning the diamond. You know, I think of Titanic, right? And the decision to drop this heart of the ocean back into the heart of the ocean, you know, where her beloved has died, and this idea of kind of the value of the diamond is not in its monetary value, but in its sentimental value, and that this is how she's expressing that commitment of her love, you know, throwing away the diamond. Mm-hmm. And you could hear it when I saw it in the movies, people gasping, and there were, you know, there were articles like, why didn't she donate it to charity?
Well, I always felt she also wanted, you know, that was for the next generation to find and maybe succeed with it and use it. That's how I romantically imagined them deep diving to retrieve it.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think that the character Marilyn Monroe played in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, Lorelei Lee, do you think that the way she used diamonds transactionally, and she wanted to get them because men were fickle and untrustworthy and she'd hold on to her diamonds, do you think that was the thoughts of a generation, or do you think that was more representative of women at the time under the Hollywood studio system?
Well, you know, it comes from a novel from the 20s, right? Anita Loos. And in that one, she's not quite so redeemed as she is in the Hollywood version. That is, in the Hollywood version, she's not a gold digger. She really loves him, right? That's the redemption, is that she truly loves this millionaire. And when his father accuses her of being a gold digger, you know, she says, "Aren't you silly? It's like a woman being pretty. It's not why you marry her, but, you know, a man being rich, it helps, you know." So this, you know, kind of wonderful Hollywood turn. I think the idea, though, that her, the way that Marilyn Monroe plays it in the film is almost like she's just stunned by diamonds. You know, it's like she's in love with them. It's just like she's mesmerized by them and delights in them. In some way, I think the emphasis is less on her wanting the security and more on her being innocently loving them, which is, again, is very different from the novel, where she really is a gold digger and she's very funny and uncomplicated on this matter.
Yes, Marilyn Monroe played it in a way that was so naive. It was hard to look at her badly or criticize her for it, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
So we don't see so many of those proposal moments or trying to get the diamond ring now, do we? I mean, female equality, empowerment, the Me Too movement. I mean, it's hard to imagine that we'd see a film like that again.
That's absolutely true. Although you have some wonderful female con artists popping up in, you know, in narratives, but it is very different. One of the things that Elizabeth Taylor introduced really was the idea that young women could wear diamonds during the day. You know, you could wear diamonds during the day. In a way, and that you could be younger and there could be a delicate kind of diamond look, very different from the older Hollywood look. But I think that the idea of women walking around Hollywood in diamonds today, the way they did in the 30s and 40s, I mean, can you imagine it? I mean, it's, you know, going to the gym in your diamonds. I mean, it's not the values of this moment so much. And I think the sense of women earning their own. They don't need to rely on men. They're not as disempowered as, of course, Mae West says, you know, it's a man's game. I just know how to play it, you know. That's still with us, but it's not so much what you can get from the man, but what you can build yourself, right?
I think Elizabeth Taylor helped that as well, didn't she? Because although there was the whole show of Mike Todd gave her this and Richard Burton gave her that, fundamentally, I think people realised she was probably funding it herself.
Interesting.
Do you think?
I don't know. It's interesting.
And doing that ultimate sort of female guile of making him think that's what he wanted to give her.
Yeah. And again, the idea of getting not just any diamond, but a diamond that had a history was also part of that narrative.
So do you think that smart movie stars would do that now, would just look at estate jewellery and not wear something that was recently created?
Well, it seems it. I mean, I was struck by it. Just, you know, I went, you know, reading about the diamonds that were worn in the last Oscars, and you know that they were almost 201, really old diamonds. And I think maybe it's also referencing old Hollywood in that.
Yes,
way.
I think that Tiffany have been really trying to reimagine their designer of in the 50s, really, Jean Schlumberger. And I think that really resonated with that style. And then we haven't had it over here, but Feud, the Capote and his swans story, I think is all old verdura in that film. But we haven't seen it yet over here, sadly.
It's fun.
Lovely jewellery.
Yes. And amazing. The whole female presentation is quite remarkable. And it's not, you know, you had Mad Men, you know, recreating the 60s look, but this is the real fancy look of the 60s. So it was something I hadn't really seen before.
The real Upper East Side look.
Yeah.
So, yes, the sort of idea of extravagance has gone. And you said that really diamonds answered the question of what women wanted, but then that wouldn't answer that question now, would it?
I wouldn't totally discount it, but it isn't part so much of you know, kind of our national narratives in that way, you know.
So still the desire and fantasy jewelry plays into that.
Yeah, I think so.
That's good. Because I was trying to think before we spoke about when I last saw significant jewelry on screen in a movie. And I was finding it hard to think in all these ones at the moment that are on the award circuit.
The ones that are set in the contemporary stories.
The contemporary films. Yeah. Yes, yes.
Well, it's not a time of representing glamour. It isn't.
But do you think people are happier to see jewels and diamonds in the role of being stolen or in heists rather than being worn as glamour ornaments?
Yeah, I mean, they're just such a remarkable object, you know, with so many meanings. I mean, they just continue to be useful in the construction of stories. I also really love the convention in Hollywood films, mostly of the mid-20th century, of, you know, the diamond thief, the jewel thief as a ladies' man, right? I mean, steals diamonds, but also sort of steals women's hearts and, you know, becomes sort of a kind of superstar in a certain way for his relation between, you know, to women and to diamonds. Yeah.
Like Cary Grant into
To Catch a Thief. Yeah.
To Catch a Thief. And is it Peter Sellers at the end of Pink Panther where he's lauded because people think he is the jewel thief?
Yeah, he comes out onto the street and it really reminded me of, you know, the reaction of the world to the Beatles. I mean, it felt very much in referencing that.
And so what attracts us to a jewel thief, do you think? When we wouldn't like it if they stole anything else.
That's one I'd really have to think about. You know, it's sort of built, it's constructed in the stories in a way. I don't know if it's a fundamental truth. But there's also, you know, the heist film is always showing very cool men. They're cool, they're calm, they can steal top cappy. You know what I mean? That sense of having finesse and being suave and being able to move in very elegant ways, you know, and pass into worlds that they don't really belong in some way because of their elegance, maybe. Some of that.
And surprising. There's a sort of, I suppose, in To Catch a Thief, she's rather entranced by him because he's a challenge. He surprises her.
Yes, she loves the challenge. I think she also is in a kind of struggle with herself, being kind of a newly minted millionaireess. You know, is she real or is she fake? What's real and what's fake? She kind of plays cat and mouse with him in a way. One of my favorite moments in the film is when she doesn't wear diamonds except for one scene where she's tempting him, you know, and the whole idea of that. She's pretending that the seduction of him is through the diamonds rather than herself, you know, Grace Kelly's gorgeous person. What Hitchcock does is so amusing because he puts the light onto the diamonds and darkens her face as if, in a way, as if Cary Grant is immune to her beauty and her perfect charm, but is only attracted to the diamonds. And it's saying something about Cary Grant, too, there, that he's somehow above female wiles, you know? He can't be drawn in that way. And then, wonderfully, there's a fireworks display happens outside the window, really echoing the diamonds. It's very beautiful.
I hadn't thought about that before, the fireworks. I'll have to go back and look at it. Hitchcock was very clever, wasn't he, with all those illusions that he created. And I guess the diamonds were part of her cool, detached character. They kind of mirrored that, didn't they?
Yes. And then how amazing that she ends up becoming the princess, the queen of this part of the world where that film is made, right? Yeah, she has such remarkable regal presence, yeah. Amazing.
And then, of course, they've been protagonists or used in plot devices in a lot of war films, either as people fleeing, emigres, using diamonds for survival, or you talk about the Schindler's List.
Yeah, portable property. In movies, you see them hidden in all kinds of amusing fashions, you know, in toys, in hems of clothing. But, you know, in Schindler's List is, of course, painful, you know, people actually swallowing their diamonds. That sense of how do you hide them? Mm. And then the scene that's very striking with diamonds is when Schindler tosses, I don't know how many diamonds, like a whole little bag of them, onto a commandant's desk to trade them for a trainload of Jews, his Jews, his Schindler's Jews.
Mm. Sort of, what's a human life worth? You also alluded to the Laurence Olivier when he played the Nazi commandant. And I think that that scene, it's like everybody who ever has seen that movie and goes to the dentist thinks about that scene.
It's a kind of a great movie, Marathon Man. It's amazing, you know, they end up in this sort of waterway in Central Park, right? And Dustin Hoffman, who's astonished that this man is willing to do all of these terrible things just for these diamonds, right? And he just starts tossing them at him, and they're standing on grating, and so the diamonds are falling into the water and just slipping away, slipping away. It's a way of expressing an alternative set of values, right? I'm throwing away these diamonds. You want them, eat them. This sense of really rejecting the values of this character, and that is also a plot twist that we get sometimes.
I think also the way you describe it as sort of going slipping through the grate, it's almost like sands of time, and the sort of ancient factor of the diamonds, kind of extraordinary.
Yeah, and like in Titanic, you know, that it's called the heart of the ocean, that element of their glistening beauty and their, you know, the watery part, you know, it works. Both the sound of them clinking and then splashing is very, it's very striking in Marathon Man.
I suppose when you think of it now, films, because they have to appeal to so many different markets. People say this is why the Marvel franchise and Batman is so successful, because it's almost like a cartoon. People can understand it visually, even if you weren't particularly understanding the language. Do you think that jewelry can appeal to different areas like that as well and be a shortcut to a story that people would understand?
It's a good question. I mean, as I understand it, a lot of the reasoning behind this proliferation of action films and Marvel films is because of the growing global marketing of films, just as you suggest, that they're accessible transculturally in some ways. Mm. In terms of translatable beauty and markers of value and beauty, I think it's a really interesting question. I'm not sure.
Because we haven't seen anything recently. You haven't, have you?
I haven't.
I suppose there's certain directors quite like jewels, like Baz Luhrmann, Moulin Rouge, The Great Gatsby. He certainly, and Catherine Martin, they really get into jewellery. I mean, they involve Tiffany in the creation of a whole set of new jewels for that film. And that's quite unusual.
There is that Baz Luhrmann sort of excess, you know. The representation of wealthy people feels to me also, again, we have Bridgerton and it's set in a fairy tale past. It's not, you know, when you see it, I think of, you know, like the 80s Dallas or something, you know, it's they're not necessarily pretty pictures, the way in which the rich are being represented in our more recent years. In some ways, Hollywood, you know, sort of saying within the stories, you know, they're just regular folks who happen to be really rich. Look, they do silly things and, you know.
So they have to suffer in some way if they have these glittering ornaments, they suffer for them.
Yeah, I think so. Or they're not to be admired and loved. We don't love them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a better way of putting it, yes. Although Downton Abbey got away with it, didn't it?
Yes.
But yeah, again, in the past, historically.
It's the current, and that choice to go to the past to show those worlds.
Do you think that's more visible now in on screen in music videos and rappers and music stars than actual Hollywood stars?
Yeah, well, you know, bling, right? It's been around a while, and I remember being surprised the first time I saw a man wearing a big diamond earring. That was a surprise, and that the masculinization of diamonds and the masculinization of jewelry is a really interesting move. And like many things, at least in American culture, it comes out of Black culture. You know, it sort of migrates. It becomes fashionable and permissible, things that weren't done before. I was noticing, you know, one of my favorite actors, Paul Mescal, you know, wearing this beautiful floral.
Yes, and he had a Cartier brooch on at the BAFTAs last week, which I'd just seen in Paris in January because it was presented for couture. And then Paul Mescal chose to wear it. It's very clever, very geometric, just on the lapels. It's almost like they've now gone on to lapel instead of actual brooches pinned. There's something coming down the lapel, almost like embroidery, but it's jeweled. So it's sort of creeping around their dinner jackets and tuxedos. And I think sometimes the men look rather more amazing than the women, actually.
It used to be, do you remember tie clips?
Yeah.
Those sometimes were, you know, and pinky rings. I mean, where men wore those things, and then of course the watches.
Yeah. So they were very limited, weren't they? And now they're not. I feel that the women limit themselves, probably for the reasons that you were saying. I long for Cher to come in one year again and just wow us all.
It's interesting. There is a little bit more conservative.
Definitely. Yeah. I suppose the change is that Hollywood's and diamonds are still linked, but now it's from a distance on the red carpet as opposed to actually on film.
Yeah. I mean, those are performances, right? I mean, people love watching those red carpet scenes, right? And enjoying these vestiges of great glamour.
And do your students, do they ever reference jewellery in film or literature? Do they ever talk about it as something that's old-fashioned and in the past or something that excites them now because they don't see much of it?
They're not so keen on black and white movies, you know, you have to really sell them. So in terms of that old idea of glamour, it doesn't resonate for them in the same way. At least that's been my experience, although they are very movie star and celebrity conscious, forget about it, you know, like hugely.
So they like colour, they want coloured films, yes.
They always refer to films that are in black and white as that black and white film, you know, it's always, you know, although films like Roma, The Lighthouse, I mean, they're kind of a little bit interested in the way people are using black and white now, but I've been really contemplating doing a course on films of the 30s and 40s. But wondering, will students come? I don't know.
Do you think that we'll continue to go into movie theatres?
I do hope so. It's so different, you know. Mm. When I've gone recently, with very few exceptions, the theatres are almost empty. Occasionally, there's a full house, you know.
I know. But it is different. You know, if you go, and I went to see the Holdovers in the theatre, you do concentrate. You do get the full resonance of that film without interruption, which does make a difference, rather than being at home.
And seeing it with a room full of people is also really different. You know, feeling other people responding and reacting, it changes it. And the sound is so great.
Do you have a favourite diamond moment on screen? What is your favourite? Do you have a favourite film? Do you have a favourite moment?
I mean, I really am a huge Mae West fan. I just adore her just as a human being. She's such a surprise in every way. I love Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. I mean, that great dance number. I love, there's a scene in Ninotchka, which is one of my favorite movies, where Greta Garbo, she's drunk and she opens up the safe where this crown jewel is that she's selling to buy wheat for her starving countrymen, and she takes it out and puts it on her head, and she's seduced by it, you know, it's very beautiful. The whole film is so interesting, the way that it posits not the values of the exiled royalty of Russia, but really the value of romance that Paris represents, and that, you know, that there's something romantic about this, you know, this crown in this moment, and feeling beautiful, which she hasn't allowed herself because she's been a sergeant in the army, and, you know, and the idea of a woman being able to feel beautiful as being tied not to capitalism but to romance, you know.
So the ultimate feminine ornament.
Yeah, although she also has a very funny hat that she buys.
Maura, thank you very much indeed for sharing your thoughts.
It's pleasure.
Your very thoughtful thoughts on this subject.
Thank you for your thoughtful questions, and it's very nice to meet you.
Thank you for listening. For this and other episodes of If Jewels Could Talk, please go to our website, carolwalton.com/podcasts. Do share it any way you can, and we love to have a rating and a comment. And we have a new YouTube channel for you to investigate as well. Join me again for the next Jeweled Nugget, and we'll be talking more about Hollywood, diamonds, jewels, the Oscars, and in particular, we'll be looking at some actual jewels that have been owned and worn by movie stars, both on and off the screen, and what happened to them. So join me then, and thank you for listening. Bye-bye. If Jewels Could Talk with Carol Woolton is produced by Natasha Cowan, music and editing by Tim Thornton, graphics by Scott Bentley, illustration by Geordie Labanda. You can find our sponsors at fuligemstones.com and me at carolwoolton.com.